climbing helps put risk in the rest of your life in a good perspective, because I think a lot of the other things in life just seem so insignificant compared to the risks that you manage as a climber. Even for a climber, the rock quality looked threatening and it looked ominous. The wall looks evil when you see it from the boat.
It was the chance to be on the same wall as the best climbers in the world. And on top of this, to do it, you know, for the scientific community. I felt such a sense of rage, I think, when I saw these icebergs. This is why we're here, because we need to tell the whole world about what's happening to Greenland.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure, this is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
In this episode, we go on a journey to Greenland, to steep rock faces surrounded by vast glaciers and massive icebergs floating far below in the ocean. Sounds pretty majestic, doesn't it? And indeed, Greenland's nature is truly unique. Not only in terms of landscape, though, but also because Greenland's glaciers and ice caps play a crucial role in climate change. The ice is melting, as everyone knows, and sea levels are rising. Therefore, the state of Greenland's glaciers could influence many coastal regions and even entire countries in the future, including their cities, such as, for example, my current hometown, New York. However, studying the condition of the glaciers and ice caps, that can be extremely challenging because of their remote locations, making them nearly inaccessible. Our two guests in this episode faced this challenge. French glaciologist Dr. Heidi Silvestre researched the effects of climate change in remote regions of Greenland, and she was supported by a team of scientists and three of the world's best climbers. One of these climbers is none other than Alex Honnold, currently perhaps the most successful and well-known extreme climber worldwide. And he has been on our guest list for quite some time. Fortunately, we now had at least a little bit of time to speak to him about this exciting project. Many of you may know Alex from the Oscar-winning documentary Free Solo, which is about his free solo climb of El Capitan in California's Yosemite National Park. I've been to that national park myself several times, and I can tell you each time I stood before this gigantic wall, I was totally in awe, and I simply couldn't imagine how Alex climbed it without a rope. I wouldn't even dare to attempt it with a rope. But anyway, in this episode, the focus is not the documentary Free Solo, it is Greenland. Alex's goal was to make the first ascent of one of the highest unclimbed rock walls in the world in one of the most remote corners of Greenland, and all of that while also contributing to science. Thus, he embarked on a memorable expedition with Heidi and a team of climbers and local experts. And the expedition was documented in the three-part series Arctic Ascent by National Geographic. If you want to watch this show, which I highly recommend, please have a look at our show notes. This is where we tell you how and where to do that. In this episode, Alex and Heidi give us insights into the challenges of a first ascent in Greenland's rugged nature, the on-site research work, and the impact of climate change on a wilderness which is crucial for the future of the planet. Have fun with the episode. Hi, Alex. Welcome to our show. Thank you so much for making the time.
Oh, my pleasure.
In your new show, you and your team explore one of the most challenging environments on Earth. You went into quite unknown territories in Greenland, and you went there to tackle a huge mountain cliff that has never been climbed before. Sounds pretty daunting to me, but it seems like challenges like this truly light you up. What excited you about this project in particular?
With this project, I was inspired by the wall, obviously. Like you said, one of the largest unclimbed walls in the world, coming straight out of the ocean. I mean, it was incredible. But also with this project, I was excited about the opportunity for climate science, you know, working with Heidi, the scientist on the expedition, to basically run different experiments along the journey. And then also just, I mean, the TV show component of it, to be able to share a place like Eastern Greenland with the world, you know, I mean, it's just a great opportunity.
So, of course, we see all the details in the show, but what was the eventual experience like for you to be in this massive rock face in the cold somewhere in Greenland?
Well, I mean, you know, the short version is that we managed to climb the wall and it was great and it was a good expedition. But the long version, I mean, yeah, it was this crazy experience. I mean, to be up on the wall and to watch the icebergs floating out to sea every day, I mean, I'd never experienced anything like that. And it's a really stark visual reminder of the impacts of climate change. I mean, obviously, icebergs are a natural part of the hydrological cycle, but the rate is the issue, you know, like how many icebergs are going out. And each block of ice that you see floating away, like each iceberg, basically represents the ocean rising by that amount.
Yeah.
And some of the icebergs that we were seeing were the size of small cities or like European villages, you know, like it's an entire village like floating out into the ocean where it'll eventually melt. And each one is like the ocean rising by the tiny fraction of a millimeter, you know, but all day, every day, you're just watching icebergs float by. You're just like, it's pretty incredible.
With that, you also hint at the climate dimension of this expedition, or better maybe to say the scientific aspect of it. Would you talk about that a little bit? You mentioned that a scientist was accompanying you.
Yeah, so we were with this scientist, Heidi Sylvester, who's a glaciologist. She's French. She's amazing. She's so passionate about the science, so passionate about science, like about ice. You know, she loves ice and snow. But she was running experiments for something like a dozen different universities around the world. And so, yeah, we were basically just executing these science projects along the way, collecting data for different organizations.
Which kind of data?
Anything, ranging from installing temperature sensors in the rocks to drilling these core samples to get a sense of how quickly the glaciers had receded in the past, like the far past, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
And then we launched this probe for NASA. So it was like a buoy that goes up and down in the fjord that measures temperature and salinity. That was part of a thing called OMG, like Oceans Melting Greenland.
OMG, okay. Not oh my God, but yeah. The other OMG.
Yeah, exactly. Whoa, it is oh my God. But basically measuring how much the ocean is melting glaciers from underneath, because glaciers are falling into the ocean, but as the ocean warms, it melts the glacier faster, which makes it fall in even faster. You know, things like that. There are a lot of positive feedback cycles at play where, you know, the more the ocean warms, the faster the glacier melts, which raises the ocean further, which melts it faster, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we are doing a variety of different projects.
As Alex mentioned, the expedition was special for him as well. Not only because he climbed a gigantic rock face for the first time, but also because he could support research on the impacts of climate change on Greenland together with his team. Glaciologist Dr. Heidi Sylvestre was responsible for the research during the expedition. She is a graduate of the Svalbard University Center and the University of Oslo, and she has been traveling the world for many years now to gain a better understanding of how glaciers and ice caps respond to climate change. For her work in protecting the polar regions, she was awarded the Shackleton Medal. We will get further insights into her research in Greenland firsthand from Heidi herself. Hi Heidi, welcome to our show and thank you so much for taking the time to discuss your biggest passion with us, glaciers. Hi.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with your most recent expedition. It led you to Greenland, and Alex Honnold already told us a little bit about the research you have done there. You were collecting data, of course, you were measuring how much the glaciers are affected by climate change already. However, of course, we are keen to hear about the research directly from you and to get much more into it. Could you share a few insights into your research on Greenland? What specific information were you hoping to gather?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this expedition was a real dream come true for me. I mean, imagine, it was incredible for a scientist like me to join these world-class climbers.
I would imagine, yes.
My gosh, it was unbelievable. But you know, I'm really glad that from the get-go, Alex and the team took the science very seriously. And this was certainly, you know, one of my goals to make sure that, okay, we're going to Greenland, we're going to do some science, but we have to make sure that the science is actually meaningful, is actually useful for the scientific community. So it took us about a year of work actually to prepare the research plans for this expedition. And after a year of all this contacting, of all this research, we were able to put together a group of 12 different research institutions, including NASA, which is pretty cool. It's always nice to have NASA on board. And together with these 12 different research institutions, we developed a plan of 18 different research protocols. So it was really ambitious because these research protocols were not just looking at my field of expertise, which is glaciers, glaciology. We were also looking at the fjords, the water in the fjords. We were looking at the snow. We were looking at the rocks, the rock cliffs. We were looking at the water running over and under the glaciers. So we really tried to get a comprehensive assessment of the health of this part of Greenland. Eastern Greenland is one of the least studied portions of Greenland. And so it was really our responsibility to collect the best possible data and really bring something back for society.
That's great to hear that you took science that seriously, that the project overall, I mean, you personally, that's not a surprise, but that the project overall took science seriously. Because to be honest, in my experience, some of these big adventures, expeditions that are led by a certain adventurer, they sometimes have a scientific aspect in them, but it's more a branding thing. It feels like to me they take one or two photos of some glacier to show, it's smaller than 10 years ago. So we did some science, but in the end, that's not really what it is about. So it sounds like this expedition was different in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, let's be very honest. It is super hard to do science on a trip like this one. It is a huge challenge. Not only the climbers are trained to do something that is mega ambitious, you know, climbing the tallest monolith in the Arctic. So that's hard enough to do. On top of this, we were filming a series for Nat Geo, which is also extremely complicated and comes with its own challenges. And then on top of everything, we had science to do. But I'm glad that, you know, a lot of the science actually didn't make it to the final edits of the series because a lot was happening behind the scenes. And from the very beginning, the production team told me, look, do as much science as you wish. Some of it will not be filmed, but we really want to make sure that you get the data that you really need. And we have to be clear about the fact that this expedition is not a research expedition. Mm-hmm. You know, there was climbing, there was a movie to be made, and on top of everything, there was some science. But the data we brought back to the scientific community is a real bonus. It's not as ambitious as it would be if I had 20 scientists around me and, I don't know, a fleet of helicopters and icebreakers
and nothing
else, you
know,
all
to think
the tools
about.
And toys, and nothing else to think about. But lucky, I think we did the very best possible research we could do on an expedition like this one. And, you know, out of 18 different protocols, we managed to successfully complete 16 of them. So 16 out of 18 is pretty decent. And I'm really glad that, you know, the scientists we are working with are super excited to get the data and to get the samples we collected.
And protocols, when you talk about that, that means basically a trial, right?
So a protocol is an experiment. So so you would use like different tools, different toys. You would collect different samples. For example, it would be like on one of the rock walls that the climbers were climbing, it would be to collect rock cores. And every single one of these experiments come from its challenges, its tools, it's, you know, rules we have to follow. And no joke, I think the whole expedition, I had like a Bible of protocols with me, and I was morning, night, day, I was going through these protocols, trying to learn them by heart and making sure that everything was falling in place. But to be fair, I would have never managed to do 16 out of 18 protocols if it wasn't for the help of the climbers. And I think that was a huge plus for me to be teaming up with these super fit, super strong, super smart people. And they really made all the difference. They really helped to achieve, you know, as many protocols as possible.
All of this sounds super exciting, but indeed also super challenging. You mentioned how difficult it was to think of everything as a team, you mentioned. I mean, it's about climbing, it's about filming, it's about the science. And when I think about my trips that I do from time to time for the podcast, I tend to do these interviews that we're doing now, but sometimes I also go out and record on location. And all I have to think about in these cases is Well, finding interesting people to talk to and interesting things to record and my own logistics. And that's already it. And it already challenges me not to miss the bus and stuff because I'm so focused on doing my work. So I can only imagine the complexity that went along with this. So it's great to hear that you had the space that you needed to do your science. And of course, you personally, you are pretty experienced with expeditions in the Arctic. It's not the first one you did. And still, you mentioned that this one was kind of a dream come true. I mean, I already got a glimpse to the answer, probably, based on what you said. But what is it that excited you so much about this particular expedition?
Yeah, there were so many aspects to this project that were insanely exciting for a scientist like me. So I'm a glaciologist. This is my background. You know, I study ice for a living.
Yeah.
And I also do a lot of science communication. And my biggest love, my biggest passion is really to spend time in the field and tell the whole world why we need to be in the field and to collect important data. And this expedition was ticking so many boxes. First of all, we were traveling to a place that is very remote, very expensive, let's be honest, to travel to for scientists. And when you look at one of the big glaciers that we surveyed during this expedition, the Dogger Jensen, the last expedition was 20 years ago. That's how difficult it is to get there. That's how expensive it is for researchers to spend time in that part of the Arctic. So first of all, we were traveling to one of the places that is, you know, the most exciting in the Arctic.
Because Second of all, it's exciting, it's remote, it's expensive, but it's also at the same time super important when it comes to climate change, right?
Exactly. I mean, Eastern Greenland is really, I mean, to use a climbing term, now that I've learned my climbing terms, it is a bit of a crux when you look at what's happening to the Arctic. So the Arctic is north of the planet, of course. It's a region that is warming 3 to 4 times faster than the global average, than the planet as a whole. And in the Arctic, we have this massive island of Greenland. And Greenland has a lot of ice. So 80% of the island is covered by ice. And it holds enough ice to increase sea levels by 6 to 7 meters. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And at the moment, I mean, you must have seen this study that was published just a couple of weeks ago. On average, Greenland loses, the Greenland ice sheet loses 30 million tons of ice per hour. So our future is directly connected to what's happening to the Greenland ice sheet. Mm. So this expedition was the chance to collect, you know, to bring some more data back to the scientific community and to better understand this part of Greenland that is a little bit of a mystery, that tends to be quite cold, quite snowy. And so we don't really understand exactly what's happening there. But then another really appealing thing about this project is that it wasn't a research expedition. And that might sound like, you know, just a challenge that I don't need to overcome. But actually, no, this is a very exciting challenge because in terms of science communication, in terms of preaching beyond the converted, teaming up with the best climbers in the world who have a huge following is a way to reach out to a wider audience. Mm-hmm. It's a way to, you know, to connect people with Greenland. It's a way to build trust in science. It's a way to show why we need to continue collecting data boots on the ground and how difficult it actually is. And of course, last but not least, I was so beyond excited to spend time with Alex Honnold, Hazel Finlay, Mikey Schaefer, Adam Aldo, all these amazing individuals who are, you know, so experienced in the field that I knew this expedition couldn't be anything but a success. And so lucky I was able to be a part of it. I was invited to join them and I'm so glad that we managed to do it.
You loved being a part of this expedition. You love, I think that already comes across pretty clearly, you love science and your work in particular on glaciers. In fact, if I have a look on your website right now, the first thing I read is, I love glaciers. That's a quote from there. Why do you love glaciers so much?
Oh, you know, I was born in the French Alps.
Uh-huh.
And I feel like I was born in it, kind of. I was born in a land of ice and snow. And lucky, both of my parents are super passionate about climbing, about mountaineering, about skiing. And since I was very, very young, they would always take me and my brother hiking and spending time in the mountains. And I often tell that story, but when I was 17, I didn't really know what to do with my life. I just knew I wanted to spend time in the mountains. And I actually met a mountain guide that year who told me, wait, you know, there are people who get paid to study glaciers. Why don't you do this? And I was like, what? This actually exists? Like, there is a real job that allows you to just, you know, make a living out of spending time in the mountains. And I think what really appeals to me about being a glaciologist is, first of all, the fact that we get to travel to the far remote corners of the planet. We get to go to places where nobody has been to before. We also have the chance, I think, to look at some of the most beautiful ecosystems on Earth. I mean, glaciers are amazing, no? Don't you think that they're the most beautiful things on the planet?
It's like gigantic ice sculptures.
It is. It is. And nature is, you know, the best artist on the planet. And glaciers are beautiful. They're powerful, but they're equally fragile.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I was lucky to become a glaciologist at the time when our science was becoming increasingly important. Because if we lose our mountain glaciers, we lose some of the most important water towers of the world. If we lose our ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica, where the whole world will be impacted by sea level rise. So today, you know, being a glaciologist is still my biggest passion. I'm very lucky to continue doing this work. But I feel, you know, that it is one thing to collect the data, to publish the results. It's also another thing, but equally important, to tell the whole world about what we're seeing, about what is currently happening and why they should deeply care about ice.
So it's about natural beauty for you, something that you already felt strongly about when you grew up. It's probably a little bit about adventure. You talked about it pretty excitedly, the fact that you get to go to these remote areas. But today it's also about relevance and urgency. You also feel what you're doing is actually meaningful.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you look at the mountain glaciers in the Alps, for example, they're bringing a lot of fresh water during the summer months. Mm-hmm. And this water is used for a series of things. It's used for drinking, for sanitation. It's used to produce hydroelectricity. And today, like on the planet, there are about 2 billion people with a B who use fresh water from glaciers.
Yeah.
So imagine how important this really is. And when you look at sea level rise, well, let's be really blunt. There are almost, I think it's 700 million people who live between 0 and 10 meters of elevation on coastlines.
I guess including me, right? I live in New York.
Oh,
as far as
absolutely.
I know, New York is, a little bit in danger as well if we look a few, I don't know, years, decades ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have pretty much locked in 1 meter of sea level rise. This will happen pretty much no matter what. And it could happen as early as the 2070s. So we might still be here to see it happening.
Yeah.
But that means that, yeah, our present and our future is in the hands of these glaciers, of these ice sheets. And the future of these glaciers and ice sheets are based on our collective decisions.
Do you have a favorite glacier? You talked about that you have the chance to travel around the world in so many areas. Do you have a favorite one?
Of course, I think all glaciologists have a favorite place, a favorite glacier. I'm actually speaking to you from the northernmost town in the world today, which is Longyearbyen in Svalbard, which is a small archipelago. We're about 1,300 kilometers from the North Pole at 78 degrees north. So a little bit further north than when we were in Greenland.
Yeah.
And on this archipelago, I do have a favorite glacier called Tunabreen. Breen means glacier in Norwegian. It is just magnificent because it's one of these glaciers. I mean, you've already seen pictures of those. These glaciers that terminate in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So they have these huge, you know, blue cliff of ice just dropping into the oceans. And these glaciers basically give birth to icebergs. And unfortunately, they contribute a lot to sea level rise. But Tunabreen is one of the glaciers that I know the most. I feel like it's kind of part of my family. You know, I go there every few months just to say hi, just to see how it's doing. And unfortunately, yeah, it's not very healthy at the moment. It's retreating really rapidly, but it's still so beautiful.
Yeah, I was wondering where you are because we're seeing each other through video, and at the corner of your stream of your video feed, I can see some snow and ice. So that is the north. I mean, it's February, so you could be wherever, but you are actually in the Arctic right now.
Yeah, we're definitely north of the wall here in the Arctic. And this place, which is very sad, this place is actually the fastest warming place on Earth. So Svalbard and parts of the Arctic Ocean
so
around it.
So that's in Norway, right?
It belongs to Norway. Uh-huh. So it's north of the Norwegian mainland. Yeah. It's an archipelago kind of floating around, drifting around in the Arctic Ocean. And this place and the water around it is warming 6 to 7 times faster than the global average. And understand that here, everything is connected to ice and snow. So the ground is made of permafrost, the frozen ground. We have 60% of the land is covered by ice. We have sea ice forming. I can see it forming in the fjord. And so unfortunately here, believe me, you see the impacts of climate change on a daily basis. And climate change kills here. So it is terrifying to see what's happening to the Arctic.
So that's probably exactly the reason of you being there, because the results of climate change are visible, and that's why you probably can also very easily collect a lot of meaningful data.
Best place to collect data, yeah. Best place to teach. There's a university like 300 meters away from me. And best place to tell the whole world about what is currently happening to the Arctic. And you know, the former Finnish president said this sentence that is so true. He said, if we lose the Arctic, we lose the world. And we mentioned it actually in the series, because this is very true. People need to understand that if we continue melting the sea ice, melting the ice sheets, melting or thawing the permafrost in the Arctic, the consequences will not just happen in the Arctic. The consequences will be far-reaching and will really affect, I mean, you mentioned it, will affect New York, will affect Miami, will affect Beijing, will affect Germany and my own country of France, of course. So what we really try to tell the whole world here in Svalbard, but also through the series Arctic Ascent, is that, you know, every data point that we collect in the Arctic is meaningful for the rest of the world. And every positive action, every positive decision that we take back home can have a positive impact on the Arctic.
And that applies to your research right there where you are right now, but of course also applies to Greenland and the Arctic Ascent documentary that you shot there. So let's talk a little bit more about that. I believe one of the glaciers there that you mentioned earlier on in our conversation, and I'm surely butchering the pronunciation, is the Daugard Jensen Glacier.
Oh, that's perfect.
Oh,
perfect
really?
Pronunciation.
Okay. Lucky me. What kind of glacier is that? Where is it located?
Oh, it is such a monster, yeah. That one. So we're talking about eastern Greenland in a place that is called Scoresby Sund. Scoresby Sund is one of the largest fjord systems in the world. It's like a big cauliflower of fjords, mm-hmm. all connected together. And during Arctic Ascent, we went as far inland via this fjord as possible, so as close to the ice sheet of Greenland as possible, in a place called Nordvestfjord. And Nordvestfjord is, when we were there, full of icebergs. There are these giant icebergs drifting around, and these icebergs mostly come from one glacier called the Daugard Jensen. And the Daugard Jensen is what we called an outlet glacier, which means that it is connected to the ice sheet of Greenland, and it drains the ice sheet. So it basically brings the ice from far inland on the ice sheet to the fjords, to the water, to the glacial Arctic Ocean.
So kind of like a massive slow motion autobahn.
Yeah, like a massive slow motion autobahn. Yeah, that's such a great way to describe it. Sometimes I think it's like a tube of toothpaste, but it's not as sexy as your description.
Well, autobahn's also not sexy, but yeah, a tube of toothpaste, that's also funny but
it,
metaphor.
Yeah,
yeah,
it,
sure.
it basically funnels a big part of the inland ice. Mm. And it's considered to be, you know, top 5, top 10 of the largest glaciers of Greenland. And so every year, the Daugard Jensen Glacier loses about 10 billion tons of ice into Scoresby Sund, into the fjord. So it's not a surprise to see a lot of icebergs. You know, some of them were like a kilometer long. They were just gigantic. But it is so distressing when you're actually there. You know, to be on a tiny dinghy, on a tiny boat, and to be surrounded by these monsters. And when you really see it in the flesh, I mean, I remember feeling my heart sinking when I was looking at this iceberg and thinking, this is sea level rise in action. This is, how are we going to stop this? I mean, this is so massive. This is a huge challenge that we're facing. But today, obviously, the more fossil fuels that we burn, the more these glaciers are going to melt and the more sea level rise we're going to get. So I was so very excited to have the chance to actually study the Dogger-Jensen Glacier because, you know, as I said before, the previous expedition had taken place 20 years prior to our own trip. So it was high time to do a little health check of the Dogger-Jensen Glacier.
And how did you do that? How do you do a health check of such a massive glacier that hasn't been studied for such a long time?
Yeah, first of all, we were really lucky to be able to connect with the scientists who had been there before and who gave us, you know, some pointers about what we could or couldn't do. And we realized very quickly that we were going to have to do some research on the ice surface itself. And the ice surface is... it's disgusting. Let's be honest. It's just a giant field of crevasses, of cracks, of ice towers that are just waiting to fall on you because the glacier is moving so rapidly because it is a funnel that literally funnels a huge amount of ice into a narrow valley. It is under a lot of tension, under a lot of stresses. And so the ice surface is totally cracked up and it's very dangerous to be there. So one of our goals was to install GPSs on the ice surface itself to measure how quickly the glacier is moving. This is very important to know how quickly the ice is going from inland to the fjord. The second thing that we wanted to install were ablation stakes. Ablation stakes is just very simple things. It's basically a plastic stake or bamboo stakes. You drill them into the ice and you go back to measure how much ice has been lost in a few weeks or in a few months. The third thing we wanted to do was to install time-lapse cameras. So time-lapse cameras, you don't need to be on the glacier itself. It's much safer. But time-lapse cameras are very interesting because they would take pictures of the glacier every hour or so. And they would allow you to not only to track how quickly the glacier is moving, you can track crevasses, you can track different ice blocks, but you can see how frequently the glacier is calving. And last but not least, the other scientists didn't need us to do this, but they're monitoring the glacier using satellite images. And so we did all of that during the expedition. But in order to do this, we needed to go to Dogger-Jensen before the expedition even started, before the climbers joined us. So I traveled to Greenland with Aldo and Adam 10 days before the actual filming would start to install all these instruments. Mm-hmm. And we really had a blast, but I think we were equally terrified and excited about this. And in the end, you know, we didn't manage to do everything we were planning to do because of many reasons, because of helicopter time, because of how dangerous it actually was to land on the glacier. But we managed to do some of it. And the most successful part of this project was really the time-lapse cameras. The time-lapse cameras worked. Not all of them worked, but some of them worked. And we managed to collect data over basically, it was 6 to 7 weeks worth of data. And we were really happy to be able to do this. And in the end, we were really surprised by what the time-lapse cameras, the GPSs, what the ablation stakes told us.
Yeah.
We realized at the end of this expedition that, you know, against all odds, the Dogger-Jensen Glacier is still quite stable. I don't want to spoil it, but anyways.
Too late now. Yeah, no, that's good news. I mean, we usually only get bad news from Greenland, so I'm eager to hear
it. Exactly. It is incredible. I mean, again, this part of Greenland is a bit of a mystery. It is very hard to collect data from these glaciers. But after 6 weeks, we went back to the time-lapse cameras. We went back to the ablation stakes and the GPS measurements. And we realized that the glacier was behaving exactly the same way that it was 30, 40 years ago. But not only that, but also the satellite images told us that the position of the front of the glacier was still pretty much the same. And this is very interesting because everything that's happening around the glacier is showing us that the place is getting warmer, the water in the fjord is getting warmer, there is more and more rain falling on the glacier.
And you mentioned the sheer number of icebergs floating around in the ocean over there.
Exactly. And despite all of this, it seems that the glacier is still doing its own thing. It's still stable. It's not that healthy, but it's still behaving exactly the same way that it was 40 years ago. And so let's be honest. I think we were all not expecting this. We were all really surprised by this discovery. But right away, I contacted all the researchers we were in touch with during the expedition. And I said, look, guys, these are the results we're getting. What do you think? And they were like, well, we're not surprised. We're not surprised because this is what the glacier has been doing for the past few decades. And in the end, I think it's quite a beautiful story to see that this one glacier in eastern Greenland is still somehow finding a way to survive. Despite the fact that, you know, everything around it is changing, this one is still very much stable. And I think it was great because when it comes to the storytelling of Arctic Ascent, it is always very important to give people hope. Mm-hmm. And this is not fake hope. This is real, real hope that we actually measured in Greenland to see that there are still some glaciers that are kind of holding it together, trying to survive against climate change. And that, you know, we need to fight for these glaciers as well. Look, everything around these glaciers in East Greenland is changing, but this one Glacier Dogger-Jensen is still stable. So it was fantastic to be able to find that exception and to tell the whole world that there are many reasons to hope for.
Yeah, because hope is what we need to keep going to fight climate change. So it's absolutely essential if it's realistic hope. Yeah, beautiful. Just a few miles away from the glacier, Dogger-Jensen, still struggling with the pronunciation, Alex, Mikey and Hazel from your team, they were climbing on a gigantic sea cliff, Inkmeet Kortilak, another difficult name. How would you describe this sea cliff? What does it look like?
Oh my God, I will always remember, I think, the first time we saw it during the expedition, because we were so excited to finally reach the last chapter of the expedition. And by that time, we had been in eastern Greenland for more than a month. So we felt like we knew, you know, we felt comfortable with the environment around us. We were feeling like we could conquer anything that was standing our way. And then suddenly our boat pilot was like, oh, I think we can start to see it. And it was, I mean, it was so gigantic. I remember it was casting this massive shadow on the fjord. And you really had to like twist your neck in order to see the top of this cliff because it was so huge. Immediately, there was this deadly silence in the team. Nobody was saying anything. And there was, I don't know, a feeling of sheer terror in the team when we saw it. I'm not joking.
So it was, you know, amazing and beautiful, I'm sure, to see, but also it sounds like really, really scary.
I mean, I think eventually we noticed how beautiful it was. But the first thing we noticed was really how scary this cliff really was. And, you know, I admire so much the climbers in our team, you know, Mikey, Hazel, Alex, of course. But I could really feel their hearts sinking when they saw it for the first time. And to see them being scared of Inkmeet Kortilak, I think made us being even more terrified. Terrified for them. We were thinking, gosh, how are they going to do this? I mean, we had, what, 2 weeks left worth of food, I think, with us. Mm-hmm. And we really started thinking, gosh, I mean, maybe this is too much. Maybe this is impossible. Who knows? I mean, it really felt terrifying.
I couldn't have described Inkmeet Kortilak any better. Beautiful and simultaneously stunning. I wasn't there myself, of course, but I've looked at the photos and I've seen the spectacular footage in the National Geographic documentary, and it looks amazing. And I'm sure the pictures and videos only hint at the scale of the rock face. In person, probably, it appears even more gigantic and majestic. You'll hear, even Alex was a little bit intimidated by Inkmeet Kortilak. Inkmeet Kortilak rises 1,143 meters into the sky, making it one of the highest unclimbed rock faces on Earth. And, just want to mention that, it is over 300 meters higher than the El Capitan rock face in Yosemite National Park, which, of course, Alex famously climbed without any safety ropes in 2017. It looks beautiful, but honestly speaking, also kind of scary to me anyway. Yeah. Was the expedition scary for you? What does it take to make you a little bit nervous?
No, that was our initial impression of the wall as well. We were like, yeah, it looks beautiful, but it looks very scary. Because even for a climber, the rock quality looked threatening and it looked ominous. The wall looks evil when you see it from the boat.
Yeah, so how did you deal with this first impression of, holy shit, this is actually scary?
Well, yeah, I mean, basically we looked at it, we're like, oh no, like this is a disaster. And then, but then you just get down to business. You just have to start taking the correct steps. So the first step was finding where you can land the boat and like whether or not you can even get out of the boat onto the wall. Mm. And we found a really good spot that was like pretty easy to jump on and off that was safe. And then from there, you start looking up and seeing what kind of features you can connect and where you can go up the wall. And so I think, you know, like so many big challenges in life, it's less daunting when you just look at the step ahead of you as opposed to the final destination. You know, like in English, the saying, like, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. You know, it's like you just start doing the thing.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's how you ended up being able to meet this challenge. But what ended up being the most challenging part of it in an environment like that? Is it the cold itself or was it something else?
On Ingmar Kortilak, the biggest challenge was actually the rock quality. I think just the fact that the rock was loose and rocks were falling down and it was hard to find good protection. So even though we were climbing with ropes, it was hard to find things to attach the rope to, because the rope doesn't really keep you safe unless you can attach it to something.
Yeah.
So if you can't find adequate gear, then it still can feel quite scary.
And the cold as an aspect, what's worse for climbing? Is it the cold when your fingers get really stiff, or is it really more the heat when you're sweaty and it's hard to grab something?
I would say both sets are challenging. I'd say the cold is maybe less pleasant in a way. Hmm. Though actually, so Ingmar Kortilak, the final wall that we climbed, was at lower elevation than the pool wall. The pool wall, the first wall that we climbed in the series, was much higher, and it was capped by the Renlund ice cap. So it was basically climbing up onto this ice cap. So there's ice on either side of the wall. And so when we climbed the pool wall, it was really cold because there was ice above and below, and we're at a high elevation, and it all just felt, it was very cold. But then climbing on Ingmar Kortilak was cold in the way that you would expect a north-facing wall in Greenland to feel, but it wasn't nearly as cold as the pool wall. So I think we felt well acclimatized by that point.
And you mentioned the crumbling rock that posed a challenge. Was the ice or the snow at all an issue that you had to deal with?
On the pool wall, for sure. Yeah. I mean, you see it in the show. You see some of the ice falling on us. And yeah, it was Ingmar Kortilak actually was such a big wall. There actually wasn't any ice or snow on the wall itself.
Yeah,
it was like just a giant clean face of rock, which is kind of amazing. I actually hadn't really thought about that till just now, but it's because it was at lower elevation, because it's surrounded by the ocean.
Yeah.
Because the ocean moderates temperature quite a bit. It's way different than having a glacier below it.
Climbing in the cold with the constant threat of falling ice from above, that is a challenge, even for the best climbers. While Heidi hasn't climbed Ingmar Kortilak on this expedition, she has tackled the so-called pool wall, as Alex just mentioned. With the assistance of the climbers Alex, Mikey, and Hazel, she aimed to collect rock samples on that particular wall. Given that you were traveling with some of the world's best climbers, I think at this stage of our conversation, the question is in order, how good of a mountain climber are you?
Please. I mean, I'm a glaciologist. I'm used to being out and about. I've been in, you know, I've joined so many expeditions during my career. But I mean, I absolutely do not consider me as a climber. And I mean, I let's be honest, I cannot when I'm surrounded by Hazel, Mikey, Aldo, and Alex. I remember, I think this is the first question Alex asked me when we were preparing this expedition. He said, "Are you a climber?" And
fair,
I looked at him
question,
and I said, I said, "Look, I've been going down moulins, but I'm not a climber, absolutely not." And I thought, "My God, this is my chance to join this expedition." Gone, probably. I'm not a climber, so yeah, it was quite scary for me to join these amazing climbers. But from the get go, we totally agreed upon the fact that I would never climb on this expedition. So I was quite comfortable actually to join them. I knew I would just do my science. I was very happy to have all my protocols, you know, under my arm and to keep busy doing my protocols. So I was kind of relieved that I was not going to do any climbing.
Yeah, but I feel like there were quite a few challenges for you anyway. I mean, I know that luckily you definitely didn't need to climb this massive cliff that we talked about, Ingmar Kortilak, also not for your research, but you got pretty heavily involved with another wall instead, didn't you? The so-called pool wall. What can you tell us about that wall?
Yeah, I mean, pool wall is 450 meters high, so it's a decent wall, and it basically, during the expedition, it was supposed to be a training war before Imikotilak, which was such a great idea, you know, to take it step by step and start to learn how these rock cliffs kind of function. And I was so glad, I was so relieved, you know. I remember the first time we looked at Pulwar that, you know, I was never supposed to climb it. I was just supposed to ski around it with Adam. And so my skis were ready, you know, all my equipment was ready. And eventually, I remember one evening, after being there for a few days, because we set up a base camp in order to really have time to look at Pulwar, one evening, the climbers came to see me and they were like, when you look at Pulwar, you know, how do you feel? You know, do you feel excited? And I'm like, guys, I mean, I can't even look at it. it is so scary from base camp. It really looked like the wall was about to fall on your face because it was so steep and overhanging in places. And then the climbers just left me alone. They were like, okay, we understand you don't like it. You know, let's not talk about it any further. And then, of course, I was like, oh my God, why are they asking me this question now? Are they thinking of changing the plan? So I went back to see them and I said, tell me the truth, you know, what are you guys thinking about? And they were like, imagine if all the science that you need us to do on the wall, well, you could do it with us instead of, you know, just teaching us how to do it. Oh, no. And
I'm already feeling, I feel my heart sinking just listening to you. I'm like, holy shit.
Ah, you know, and at first I said, absolutely not. I'm not a climber. And then they reassured me immediately because I didn't know what they had in mind. I didn't know what I didn't know, basically. Mm-hmm. And so they said, look, you're not going to climb, you know, holding on these little rock ledges. We can install fixed lines and you would just use what we call jumars, which are, I don't know if you're a climber, but it's kind of these little things that you drag yourself with going up fixed ropes.
Yeah.
So you don't need any technical abilities. You just need to be strong enough to lift yourself up along those fixed lines.
It's still super exhausting and of course scary just because of the surrounding, but you don't need to be a technically awesome mountain climber for that.
Yeah, yeah. You don't need to be gifted, technically gifted at all. And then, I mean, come on. It would have been so stupid for me to say no to this. It was the chance to be, I mean, not to climb with the best climbers, but to be on the same wall as the best climbers in the world. And on top of this, to do it, you know, for the scientific community. And, you know, actually a friend of mine, you know, was one of the researchers who was interested in getting samples from Pulwar. And I thought, oh, come on, for her, for Rachel, I should really try to be there. And in the end, you know, we aimed to collect rock cores all the way up Pulwar. And this must have been one of the most disgusting research protocols we had to implement. It was so hard. It was so difficult. We struggled so much. But I'm so glad I was there to see actually how difficult it was.
Disgusting and, because you have to drill, of course, in the wall and the surrounding circumstances probably pretty challenging.
You know, it was snowing, it was raining, you were like 200, 300 meters high with a drill that was misbehaving, and drilling one rock core would take 2 to 3 hours.
Oh.
And sometimes, you know, we would run out of battery, so you had to go all the way down to base camp. Anyways, it was very difficult. And I'm not sure I enjoyed, you know, even 1 minute of being on Pulwar.
Not sure.
It was terrifying. I was so scared. I was absolutely scared.
I was going to ask you, like, did you ever ask yourself, how the hell did I end up here in a situation where I'm climbing up this wall that, by the way, has never been climbed before with some of the best climbers in the world, but without me having any kind of climbing experience myself? How did this happen?
Oh, you know, I had to trust them.
Yeah.
I had to trust them because if they basically gave me the confidence to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they took a lot of time to teach me how to do it properly. Mikey, Aldo, well, everyone, all the climbers really helped me, Alex and Hazel. And, you know, I would always try to remember, what are you doing? Why are you on this wall? You know, and I knew I was on this wall for science, and this was my guiding, my North Star. You know, that was the reason why I was on that bloody wall. And it was, you know, pushing me to continue, you know, one step at a time, one Jumar movement at a time, going up this wall. But I would always remember the time let me tell, give you a little bit of the behind the scenes, because it's very interesting when you're filming a documentary with climbers. So I remember the very first time I was on the wall, because I was on the wall for a few days, and then we did the final ascent in order to collect, you know, all the samples. But the very first time I was on the wall, so I had just learned how to do this, how to go up the fixed lines. I was like, I don't know, 100 meters high. And there was a little bit of a technical section. I mean, it was very terrifying for me. It was very technical for me. And I remember one of the directors of the movie was like 10 meters above me, just above the technical section. And he took his walkie-talkie to call base camp. And he said, ksh, ksh, base camp, base camp. Heidi is about to start the technical section. Get the drones. Get the drones ready. And I was like, oh no. Oh, no, don't get the drones now.
That doesn't
sound
good.
So this is what happens sometimes. Yeah. Not only you're there, like, trying to survive, you're trying to focus on the science, and then suddenly there's a drone, like, 10 meters behind you, flying, hoping to catch, like, a dramatic moment. And, you really had to stay calm in those circumstances.
How high up did you get on this wall?
All the way up. So it was about, 400, 450 meters. Yeah.
I mean,
and, you know,
I don't,
when we reached the...
I don't even need technical difficulties in this situation. I just imagine just the sheer height, and then the ice, the weather, there was a slight snowstorm going on, then icicles were falling down on you from the top. Just being there, hanging in this wall is already scary to me in my mind.
Oh, yeah, no, I was so scared. You know, I totally agreed. And, you know, I wasn't the only newbie on the wall. There was also Adam, who is an amazing person who is a part of our team. And Adam, I think, had even less experience than I had. So it was crazy for the both of us to be on the wall. And when we reached the top, Adam looked at me and he took a big breath and he said, never again. We're never doing this again. So, yeah, it was a great experience in the end. I mean, after all I've just said, in the end, I'm so proud that we've managed to do it. I'm so thankful for the climbers to have dragged us up this wall, because it was definitely really scary for them to have all these newbies on the wall.
Yeah, it doesn't make their job easier either. Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I was stepping on all the ropes I wasn't supposed to step on. I mean, it was crazy what I was doing, all the mistakes I was doing. But basically, I'm eternally thankful and I will never forget that crazy experience.
How did you manage your fear in this wall to be able to function, to not only be able to be dragged up there somehow by someone like Alex, but to do your work and to not panic?
Yeah, I mean, I've been in really scary circumstances on expeditions, you know, really circumstances when you really fear for your life. And what I've always learned is that you should try to focus really on what you can control. You can't control the weather. You cannot control the icicles falling on you or the rock falls. You cannot control the other climbers. But what you can control is, you know, just going up one step after the other and trying to do the best possible science. And so, you know, I would try to never look down. I would try to really keep my focus on the rock that was just in front of me and on, you know, all my actions and making sure I wouldn't do a mistake. And I was trying to communicate as much as I could to the rest of the team. And in the end, you know, one step at a time, one step after the other, eventually you make it to the top. But it was so scary. And I was really worried about, you know, having one of these moments when you become totally paralyzed by fear. And lucky it never happened. But I think the reason why I thought I could do it was because the climbers made me believe, you know, gave me confidence that I could actually go up that bloody wall. So I'm so glad they entrusted us to be able to do it.
You made it all the way up. And of course, you were able to collect quite a few of these rock samples that you were after. What can those rock samples tell us? Why were you so keen to get them?
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating, actually, what these rock cores can tell us. So imagine Pool Wall is this giant cliff of 450 meters high. Mm-hmm. During the last ice age, 20,000 years ago, Pool Wall was totally covered by a bigger Greenland ice sheet. The Greenland ice sheet was much bigger than it is today. But at the end of the ice age, naturally, conditions changed and the ice sheet started to retreat, which is completely normal at the end of an ice age. And so what happened is that this massive cliff became more and more deglaciated. So imagine that the thickness of the ice decreasing and decreasing century after century. And so what the rock cores will be able to tell us is, for how long have these rocks seen the sun? And so we're literally looking at the degree of tanning. How tanned are the rocks? Have they been seeing the sun for a very long time, or did the deglaciation take, was very quick? Was it very slow? How did it happen? Did it happen in steps? Did it happen very abruptly? And so by looking at the rate of deglaciation along the rock cliff of Pourvoir, it will give us basically data on how the Greenland ice sheet behaved when the conditions changed at the end of the ice age. And so, you know how climate models work? They all work based on the past, based on how things changed in the past. So if we're able to understand how Greenland behaved at the end of the ice age, 20,000 years ago, by putting this information in our computer models, we can better understand, we can better foresee, project how Greenland is going to react in the future to man-made climate change. So that's why it was so important to get these rock cores. And let's be fair, these rock cores are super difficult to collect. I don't know how many climbers, I don't know how many scientists would have been able to collect these rock cores if it wasn't for these amazing climbers. And so right now, the samples, they have already been analyzed at Liverpool University by my friend Rachel. And now they are, if I'm not mistaken, at the University of Buffalo. And they're being analyzed by Jason Briner. And he's looking at the degree of tanning, basically, of these rocks. You know, have they been seeing the sun for a long time or not? And yeah, I'm very eager to start getting some results and some interpretation. But, you know, science is slow, so they're still being analyzed as we speak.
Absolutely fascinating. Yeah. Alex described the surreal experience of witnessing these icebergs that we've mentioned drifting past while climbing, to have this perspective from up high down to these icebergs floating around. When you reminisce about this expedition, what specific scenes or moments or images stand out to you? What memories are most vivid and have left the most lasting impression on you? What would you say?
Mm. You know, I think I have exactly the same memory from this expedition. I remember that one time, you know, I would do a lot of science even if we were not filming. So I remember that one day I left base camp at the end of the expedition. I just went by the fjord and I had to do this very simple protocol, which was to drop hydrophones, microphones in the water. Mm-hmm. And hydrophones are very helpful in these icebergs filled fjords because these hydrophones will capture all these little air bubbles that escape from the icebergs, and it gives us, it's a bit technical, but it gives us a rate of melting. It gives us an idea of how quickly the ice is melting in the fjord. The more air bubbles are being released, the faster the icebergs melt. And so I was there on my own. There was like absolute silence and I was on my own, which is quite rare during this expedition. And I just remember dropping the hydrophones and then sitting down. And then just looking at this army of icebergs drifting past me. And I was like 10 centimeters away from the water. So I could really feel, I could feel the cold of the icebergs drifting past me. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, here I see icebergs every day. It wasn't the first time I've seen icebergs. Mm-hmm. But to see so many of them and such huge ones, I mean, they were absolutely enormous. It was literally like seeing an army of white walkers, you know, drifting past me. And you have to understand that behind each and every one of these icebergs is New York. I mean, it's Miami, it's Shanghai, it's France, it's Bangladesh, it's the Netherlands. It's millions of lives that are behind each and every one of these icebergs. And I just couldn't believe it. I was floored at the thoughts of, you know, of the magnitude of this, of this behavior of these icebergs and the volume, the sheer volume of ice that was drifting past me. And I thought, my gosh, you know, how are we going to stop this? It looks unfeasible, unrealistic to think that we will ever manage to stop this, but we have to. If we do not stop this, you know, we're going to lose a lot of lives. We're going to lose lives and livelihoods. And we really need to help people understand that this is happening. It's happening every second, every minute in Greenland. And when I was there sitting by the fjord, I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, I wish world leaders would see this. I wish, you know, the heads of the most polluting companies on earth would see this. Because when you see it, I mean, you feel it deep inside of you. You feel it in your chest. You feel it in your heart. And I had goosebumps all over me because how terrified I really was. But to me, I felt such a sense of rage, I think, when I saw these icebergs that I instantly thought, gosh, this is why we're here, because we need to tell the whole world about what's happening to Greenland.
In my mind, this also puts a spotlight on these two dimensions of your work that must be a factor anyway. On the one hand, a factor for you. I don't know. Please tell me about it. On the one hand, you are witnessing this enormous beauty, both on glaciers anywhere, but also in a moment like this where you are observing these icebergs floating away, huge, huge icebergs. And you described it right now as terrifying, of course, if you think about what it means. That makes total sense. But it must also be amazingly beautiful to see that. How do you deal with these extreme perceptions? I mean, as I said, that's probably part of your work overall, because overall, there are some exceptions, of course, but overall, glaciers, icebergs are not doing well right now. The change is terrifying, but the way the change sometimes looks visually must be beautiful. But still, you are kind of witnessing, describing, analyzing change and, in the end, destruction in your work for years and decades.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like I always have two hats. I'm always wearing two different hats. The one hat of being just, you know, such a huge lover of these beautiful landscapes. Alex would always describe them as, you know, fantasy. It looks unreal because of how beautiful it is. The mountains are all above 3,000 meters. The giant, the fjords are extremely deep. They're very wide. The icebergs are all monsters. Everything is huge in that part of the world and just stunning, just stunning. I think we have to see it, how beautiful it is. And, you know, that's why it was so interesting to do this expedition with these non-scientists, because they were totally falling in love with Eastern Greenland. And who wasn't? I mean, we all were. But at the same time, I would often be the party pooper here. And I would often say, well, look, yes, this is beautiful. The blue of the ice, you know, the water, the tall mountains, the sun. But here is what is actually happening. This is exactly what we're looking at. We're looking at climate change in action, and this is not normal. You know, if we had been here 100 years ago, the amount of ice would have been double what we're seeing now, and this is really abnormal. And I would always try to, I think the way I described my mission on the trip is that I would try to put a pair of glasses on their eyes and help them to read the landscapes in a different way, to give them enough cards to describe, to be able to decrypt the landscape around them. And even though, you know, what I would tell them was rarely happy, was never exciting or encouraging, it was very important for me not only to have them totally fall in love with these landscapes, but also realize how powerful, but also how fragile these landscapes truly are. And I think the two are actually very important. The two emotions are key, because we really need people to fall in love with these landscapes. If you do not fall in love with the Arctic, if you do not fall in love with the icebergs, with the glaciers, why should you care, right? Look at how much we care about a panda or a whale. You know, we care about them because they're beautiful. They're so cute. And because we think they're beautiful, we want to protect them. So to me, it was super important right at the beginning of the expedition that not only our team, but also the viewers would totally fall in love with these ecosystems. But eventually, I really wanted them to understand what was happening, you know, before their eyes. It wasn't just beautiful. It wasn't just magical. It really is. But what we're seeing is an ecosystem that is terribly impacted by climate change, that is really unhealthy. And even if we are in one of the most remote wildernesses of the planet, this wilderness is being terribly impacted by the burning of fossil fuels that is happening in America, that is happening in Europe, that is happening in Asia. So, you know, I really hope that they will never forget how, you know, that the climbers will always remember how much they love these landscapes. Because, you know, there is this quote that says, you protect what you love, you love what you understand and you understand what you have been taught. Mm. This is a quote from Baba Dioum, who is a Senegalese engineer. And this is very true. You have to understand in order to care. And I really hope that the people watching Arctic Ascent will not only fall in love with these landscapes as much as we did fall in love with these landscapes, but that they will also deeply care and care enough to be propelled into climate action.
Heidi's work conveys the beauty and fragility of glaciers worldwide. This is important because threatened ecosystems are often kind of distant. They feel far away, physically and emotionally, because, of course, many people have never seen them firsthand and probably never will, especially when they are as remote as those in Greenland. Heidi hopes that large projects like this National Geographic documentary series can help make the impacts of climate change more accessible for viewers. For Alex, too, the expedition in Greenland, as we have already heard from him, was very special. Naturally, his everyday life doesn't always consist of one great adventure after the other. Instead, he spends much of the year training near his family in Nevada.
Yeah, it was a pretty multi-layered project. Do you get more satisfaction nowadays from big adventures, big projects like this, or from your climbing routine at home when you practice and improve your climbing techniques just by yourself without any media attention? What do you prefer today?
Oh, I would say, I don't know. I mean, I guess I spend probably 8 or 10 months of the year just climbing by myself at home, mm-hmm. working on my own techniques, practicing. And I love doing that. And it's great. I mean, I probably get more satisfaction, though, from an expedition like this, where you go to a remote, beautiful part of the world, you climb on climb walls, you make a television program, you know, you highlight the science. I mean, I would say an expedition like this, it satisfies so many different desires. We're like, oh, this is incredible. But if I had to do expeditions like this all year round, I don't know if it would be quite as satisfying, because, you know, it's like you can really only muster the energy for something like this, you know, maybe a couple times a year max, because it's a big undertaking. I mean, 6 weeks of camping in the cold, just like, I mean, it's a big trip.
And you have done many of such trips, many quite groundbreaking projects. Do you feel that the expectations for you and what you are up to nowadays are pretty big? Does that ever pressure you to come up with the next big thing?
I mean, yeah, in some ways, I agree that expectations are maybe high. Uh-huh. On the other hand, I think that the success of the film Free Solo in some ways has given me more freedom, because the reality is that nothing I do ever again in my life will rival the success of Free Solo. And so, you know, in a way, that's actually very liberating, because it means I can just focus on whatever projects I want to do, because I know that they're not going to surpass what I've done in the past.
That does make sense.
I mean, it's like a slightly sad way to look at it, but in... Well, I don't know if it's sad or it's just totally liberating.
It reminds me of like Peter Jackson, the director of The Lord of the Rings, who also says like, I mean, that will be on my tombstone. I'm the Lord of the Rings guy. So now he just does what he loves to do, doing awesome documentaries and stuff like that. He definitely feels liberated by that, I guess. Just reminds me of that.
I didn't know that, but that is actually that's exactly the same thing. Uh-huh. And the thing is, I bet he's in the same position where I'm sure he's very proud of Lord of the Rings, and I'm very proud of Free Solo. And yeah. It's something that I'm proud of the climbing. I'm proud of the film. You know, it's like, if you're going to be remembered by one thing, at least it's something that you're really proud of.
That's great.
And so I think that it is totally liberating, because then it allows you to just do things that you're passionate about, things that you're inspired by, things that you think are worthwhile.
Has the way, when we talk about things that are worthwhile and how you think about that, has the way you think about climbing itself and also the associated risk-taking, has that changed at all in the last few years for you?
I'm not sure if you know. I mean, I have a family now. I have an almost 2-year-old, about to have another child. So I'm about to have 2 daughters. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's changed the way that I think about risk too much, just because I never wanted to die climbing and I still don't want to die climbing. And so I think that's pretty consistent. But I definitely think that it's changed the way I choose to spend my time and the types of projects that I'm willing to be away from the family for. And so, you know, I think the Arctic Ascent is a good example of a project that feels worthwhile to me. Mm. You know, it's like it means enough to me that I'm okay being away from the family for 6 weeks. But I think that other types of climbing projects just might not quite mean enough to leave the family.
So it's more about the emotional depth and impact of a project like that today.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. Or, you know, or something like that. Like a project has to have a little more, like it has to have enough to it to be worth. Basically, I guess the thing is that now I have a very good reason to be at home. So I need an even better reason to be away from home.
That makes sense. You mentioned that, of course, you never wanted to die climbing. That's why you prepared really well all the time. Do you feel, looking back, that you always had a good balance in your career in terms of risk taking for going far but not too far?
I mean, I think that I've always made pretty good decisions. I mean, there are certainly some climbs where I pushed it harder than others, none of which you would know about, I don't think, because they're all the things that you do off camera or like with no media. It's like the things that you do for yourself where you're just like, oh, I think I can just get away with this. Like, I'll just try. Like, I had a big free solo that was leading up to El Cap a couple years before where it's in the middle of nowhere in the mountains. And I did a little bit of preparation and I planned to do several more days of preparation. But then I ran out of propane in my van and I couldn't cook. And it's like a really long drive to go back into town. And I was just like, ah, I'll just do it tomorrow so I can leave for once because I didn't want to have to drive back and forth. You know, things like that where you're willing to like roll the dice a little more. You're like, well, I'm just going to get by with half the preparation I thought I needed because I don't want the inconvenience of driving to town and back a couple times. And so...
Yeah,
I don't know. You know, there were things like that in the past, but I think overall, I've been pretty. I can't say conservative, but I think that I've made good choices.
I wouldn't say conservative, but yeah. You're still here, so evidently the choices were good enough.
yeah, exactly. I think so far they've been good enough.
How do you think about risk taking in your life besides climbing? How do you decide if something is worth the risk, a risk or not?
Well, actually, I think that climbing helps put risk in the rest of your life in a good perspective, because I think a lot of the other things in life just seem so insignificant compared to the risks that you manage as a climber. And so a lot of the things that seem scary in real life, you know, like, oh, you know, I'm not sure if my flight's going to be on time. And like, what if the hotel doesn't have any bookings? You're like, who cares? You know what I mean? Or like, you know, a lot of the things that people get stressed about in normal life, I think that when you're used to managing risk as a climber, just do not seem even... they don't even seem a little bit scary. You know, you're just completely unstressed. You're like, I'll find another hotel. I'm like, I'm sure I'll sleep somewhere. Like, I will be fine because I won't be in physical danger. And so I think that as a climber, when you manage physical risk all the time, it just makes all the other risks in life feel not mundane, but just so much more manageable.
And since you mentioned that, you are pretty satisfied with what you will be remembered for, which is free solo, of course. And now you also tell us that you are pretty comfortable with any kind of degree of risk in your everyday life. That sounds like you feel pretty well-rounded today, pretty relaxed about where you are in life.
I think so. I mean, yeah, I think if you can look at your life and think, you know, I've basically made good choices and I'm pleased with the things that I've done. I mean, I think that's... you know, ready to die.
Hopefully not.
But yeah, hopefully not too soon. But honestly, if it happens, you'd be like, you know, it'd be fine.
I used the time well.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think we used this time well. And unfortunately, it's already over now. So thank you so much for making the time for this. Thank you, Alex.
No, thank you. No, I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Yeah, nice job.
The success of Free Solo allows Alex to realize projects like Arctic Ascent. Projects that inspire him and that he can pursue with great passion. Heidi sees tremendous potential in this kind of collaboration between climbers and scientists.
You know, I will continue fighting day and night for these ecosystems and I will never give up. And I really hope that also that Arctic Ascent and projects like these ones will be able to inspire not only scientists to work with climbers, adventurers, explorers, but also for these athletes to continue working with scientists, because I feel that there is a huge potential of continuing to team up together. So we're stronger together, so let's continue following this trend and let's continue, you know, trying to make a difference to our societies.
You definitely made a difference to me with this show, but also with this conversation. It was a fascinating look into your work and into your world. And I thank you so much for sharing it with us on screen and also in this conversation in such a passionate way. Thank you so much, Heidi.
My pleasure, Erik. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks. That was our episode with Heidi Silvestre and Alex Honnold. I hope you enjoyed the two interviews as much as we did, and that Alex's and Heidi's enthusiasm has rubbed off on you at least a little bit. As mentioned, if you want to learn more about the expedition, definitely check out the 3-part documentary by National Geographic. And if you liked this episode, please rate it on the podcast app of your choice. Then hopefully Alex will visit us again in the future with perhaps a little bit more time to spare than he could this time, as there is certainly plenty more to discuss with him. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye. Until next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.